Well, in our studies in the book of Esther, we're in the second to last chapter. We're almost at the end of this wonderful story that has provided us with so much food for thought. And as we come then to this chapter, we need to note that the year is 473 BC. It's in Persia that these events are taking place, in the great superpower of the world. And it's towards the end of February, the end of the Jewish year, the month of Adar. And there in Persia, which stretches from India in the east to Ethiopia in the west, over 127 different provinces over which King Ahasuerus is the emperor, people are gathering. In small towns, in large cities, people are gathering. And there's two distinct groups forming. There's a group that is barricading itself behind defences. And there's another group that is gathering weapons to take the offensive. Both sets of people are citizens of Persia. Both groups are under the royal protection. Both are acting on this day with the king's permission. It's an intriguing situation. Two groups of people at war with one another, totally legally. Those who are behind defences have built those defences at the decree of the king. Those who are travelling towards them in bands of twos and threes or tens and twenties with differing kinds of weapons do so at the king's decree. But the outcome for each, as we read, is very different. On that day, the time came for the king's command and his decree, or perhaps we should say decrees, to be executed. On the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occurred. Everything is turned on its head. The great plans of Haman, the architect, which were being put into place by his followers, are brought to nothing. The building collapses around their ears, as it were, and they're left humiliated. The Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. They gathered themselves together in the cities throughout all the provinces, and no one could withstand them. It's a wonderful story if you're a Jew. It's not a bad story if you're a Persian. But it's an awful story if you're a Persian who hates Jews. What's going on in this chapter, and how should we understand the things that we're told here? How do we understand words like slaughter and destruction, and that the Jews did whatever they pleased with those who hated them? Aren't these the kinds of words that we would expect to rejoice over? Or have the Jews gone a little bit too far? Have they used their rights and their privileges beyond what the king ever intended? Well, let's consider for a moment. We're told in verse 16 that the Jews around all these 127 provinces of Persia killed 75,000 of their enemies on that one day. Now, by anyone's calculation, you would agree that slaughter is a valid description of what went on. 75,000 people killed in a day. But is it unjust that so many should die? It has been estimated that living in Persia at that time, there were probably in excess of 500,000 Jews. In excess of 500,000 Jews living in Persia. They killed 75,000 of their enemy. Had Esther not been successful in her approach to the king, had the scepter not been extended to her, had she not found favour in the king's eyes, had he not offered to do for her anything that was within his power to do for her, and had he not agreed to the decree that Mordecai and Esther had drafted and sent out to all the provinces, allowing them to defend themselves. On that particular day, rather than 75,000 people dying, in excess of 500,000 people would have been slaughtered. It puts it into some kind of perspective, doesn't it? Furthermore, we need to consider the vastness of this empire. 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia is the way the Book of Esther describes it. Now we know that in Shushan, the citadel, on the 13th day of Adar, 500 people were killed. That's in one city. 500 people were killed. One city of one province out of 127 provinces. If you just took one city in each of the other 126 provinces, 600 people would need to have been killed in each of those cities to have made up the 75,000. It's not so great a number when you put it in that format. And we're told that it wasn't just in the cities, it wasn't just the capital city of each of those 127 provinces, but in all the walled cities, and even in the unwalled villages, the Jews had had to defend themselves, and their enemies had come against them. So we're not talking about 500, 600 in any one place. We would expect that in Shushan, Haman lived there. Haman's 10 sons, who would want to exact revenge on the Jews for what had happened to their father and the taking away of their inheritance, you'd expect that in Shushan. There, that was the hotbed of hatred towards the Jews. But in the other places, it may only have been 5 or 10, maybe 50 or 100. And in many places, probably none at all. For fear of the Jews fell upon all the people. It's interesting to note too that all the officials were on the Jews' side. The satraps, the governors, all those who were doing the king's work, helped the Jews. Helped them build their barricades, equip them with weapons to defend themselves. These were ordinary people. They were law-abiding citizens. They weren't out to murder and kill just anyone who happened to come across their path. They were defending themselves within the king's decree. And so 75,000 may seem an awful lot of people to have been killed in one day. But given the lives that were saved, and given the spread of 127 provinces in which these events took place, it's not so great a figure after all. And it was all being done to protect innocent lives. Not a soul that was killed unjustly. They were the enemies of the Jews. They had taken up weapons against the Jews. They were out to kill the Jews. They just reaped for themselves what they were hoping to exact on the Jews. The punishment certainly fits the crime in this particular instance. What about those 10 sons of Haman? They're all named for us there very deliberately. It's interesting. I'm told by the commentators that in the Hebrew Bible, when you open up in Esther, these names are all in a column, one under the other. And the Hebrew is written from right to left, read from right to left as well. And so down the right-hand side of the page is column of names. It's the only place, apparently, in the Hebrew Bibles where that's the case. And so if you were flicking through a Hebrew Bible, suddenly you come to this place where there's a blank spot on the left-hand side of the page that would stand out. So every time a Jew opened his Bible and flicked past that page, it would be a reminder of God's justice against those who had risen up against his people. But isn't it going a little bit too far? I mean, they're dead. They've been killed quite justly. Obviously, they've taken up arms against the Jews. They've sought to kill the Jews. But to hang dead bodies on the gallows? Isn't that going a little bit too far? Isn't this a little bit sick? What's going on here? Well, it's worth remembering in the first place who it is that asks for this to happen. The king hears about the results of the first day, and he was told that 500 people had been killed. And he asks Esther, what do you want now? What's your petition? It will be granted to you. What is your further request? You see, the king isn't grudgingly doing this. He hasn't grudgingly read the decree that Mordecai and Esther had written up in his name and thought, oh, well, I wish I hadn't given Mordecai the ring so that he could seal this decree. He's not feeling that way at all. He's not feeling any remorse, any regret over this second decree. In fact, as he stands there before Esther, thinking about the 500 in his capital who have lost their lives, he thinks, this isn't enough. Justice hasn't been served here. So he asks her, what do you want? And she tells him, well, another day. And the 10 sons of Haman be hanged. It's Esther who asks for this. Esther, who has been the emblem of perfectness throughout this story. She's done what has been right and just throughout it all. She initially showed some reluctance about going in before the king, but as soon as Mordecai had explained the situation to her more fully, she was willing to risk her own life in order to protect the Jews. She's not the sort of person who comes across in this letter as someone who's vindictive, who's someone who's just out for revenge for the sake of getting revenge because she could get revenge. She's not that sort of person at all. And yet she's asking for this to be done. Why would someone like Esther want this awful thing to happen? Hanging up these 10 dead bodies. Well, surely we must see it as being a lesson. There's still undercurrents of hatred, you see. The second day comes and it goes, and in Shushan the citadel, a further 300 people are killed. 300 people who take up arms against the Jews, despite having seen what happened the previous day. See the level of animosity towards the Jews there was in Shushan. One day wasn't going to be enough to quell this hostility. And even a second day of simply allowing the Jews to defend themselves against their enemies. Remember that their enemies had no legal right on that second day to war against them. they had been given one day to annihilate the Jews. The Jews were given a second day to defend themselves, but their enemies weren't given a second day to war against them. So these 300 who lost their lives in Shushan were violating the king's law. They were taking up arms against those who were protected by the kings. You see the height of their arrogance here. They knew that they were disobeying the king. They knew that they were going against the wishes of the queen of Persia. They were disobeying the law of the land. And yet they were still willing to risk their lives and to do so. So great was their hatred towards the Jews. And so part of Esther's request that Haman's sons be hanged is that there would be this visible demonstration that this enmity against the Jews was not going to be tolerated in the least. Those who tried to take the life of a Jew would be humiliated. And so justice would be seen to be done in Persia. Why wasn't their decree sent further than Shushan? Well, they didn't have email. They didn't have internet. They didn't have telephones. Everything had to be sent out by courier on horseback. And it wouldn't get very far in the few hours between the end of the day, nightfall on the 13th day and sunrise on the 14th day. So it's limited to Shushan. But a message is being sent to all. The Jews are under the king's protection. And so the sons of Haman are hanged as a lesson to all, as a sign to all. The 75,000 lose their lives justly at the hands of the Jews. And an extra day is given so that those who have missed, who have hidden, who have avoided justice on one day, receive it on the next. They cannot avoid it forever. Now there's one other thing that needs to be noted, because it's stated three times in this passage, and that is that the Jews, having exacted vengeance on their enemies, destroyed those who came against them, never took anything from them. They didn't touch the plunder. They killed all these 75,000, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. They killed 800 in Shushan, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. That shows incredible restraint. Think about what happened a few centuries earlier when Saul was told to go and to kill Agag and to destroy everything that he had and to destroy all the plunder. Saul neither killed Agag nor did he destroy the plunder. He took it for himself. He gave it to the soldiers. He saw it as their just reward. Think about things that have happened in more recent times. Think about what went on in Iraq during the war. As soon as the system of law and order had broken down as a result of the war there, plundering was going on right, left and centre. That's human nature, isn't it? And here are some Jews who, by decree of the king, not only are allowed to defend themselves, but also are allowed to take whatever belongs to their enemies. We're told that they did whatever they pleased to those who hated them. And we're to understand by that, surely, in the light of the fact they didn't take the plunder, that their enemies couldn't do anything. They were helpless before them. The Jews did whatever they wanted. They couldn't stand before the Jews. That's the sense of what is being said there. Not that the Jews were vicious and cruel and chose to kill them in a way that would cause the pain to endure the longest, or anything like that. They're not talking about torture or anything like that here. It's simply saying, wherever the Jews went to defend themselves, no one could stand against them. Their enemies fell like flies. But they didn't take the plunder. They restrained themselves. So even when you see the figure of 75,000, you understand it within this context of restraint, of holding back their just rights, and also of what maybe they're inclined in their hearts to do. Incredible restraint is being shown by these Jews. Why? Is there a particular lesson for us to learn from this? Well, the whole point of this story is to demonstrate the sovereignty of God and his preservation of his people. This war on this particular day, the 13th day of Adar, is all about survival. It's not about personal enrichment. It's not about lining one's own pockets. This is about survival. This is about life and death. And the Jews, satisfied with the preservation of life, weren't greedy for more than that. Now, there's some concluding thoughts for us to learn from this chapter before us. It's wonderful to see the sovereignty of God, isn't it? To see, looking back over what we've learned over these past few weeks, and to see the incredible predicament that these Jews were in, with the whole of the legal system of the greatest empire in the world against them. And yet they've come out on top. The opposite occurred. Everything that a few months earlier we would have expected to have happened, the annihilation of the Jews, didn't happen. And instead, their enemies were destroyed. But the people of God are always going to have those who oppose them. In Shushan, the day after that, those events, there were still 300 to be killed. And no doubt there were more who escaped even the second day. And it was only in Shushan that a second day of fighting was allowed. In all the other cities, in all the other provinces, surely there were enemies of the Jews who escaped the sword on that particular day. When Nehemiah journeyed back to Jerusalem in years following these events, he faced opposition there. He had those among his enemies there who thought they had friends enough in Shushan that they could send letters blackening the name of Nehemiah. The people of God will always have enemies, because God always has enemies. Throughout the centuries of this world's existence, God has had his enemies, and God's people have had their enemies. We should remember that. We shouldn't expect throughout our lives to have it easy. If we do expect that, we will be bitterly disappointed as Christians. To live as Christians in this world is to be at war constantly. Not against people necessarily, but against principles, against philosophies, against ideologies. We've seen it even this past week in the legislation in New Zealand. And that's going to carry on. And it hardly seems that we have time to take breath and to rest our weary limbs when there's another onslaught and another onslaught. But the book of Esther teaches us that God is sovereign. God is in control. God is faithful to his promises. He had promised the Israelites that these people, the Amalekites and the descendants of Agag, would all be destroyed. And he does it here in the pages of the book of Esther. Haman hung on the gallows. His 10 sons destroyed as well. God would fulfill his promises to his people. And he does the same today. He still fulfills his promises. He is still the faithful God. And the third lesson that we can learn is that justice does come to all. 300 men avoided justice on one day, only to be caught up by justice on the next. And perhaps there were others who, for the rest of their lives, got away with the fact that they had taken up arms against the Jews on the 13th and 14th of Adar in the year 473 BC. But justice even caught up with them eventually, because God reigns on the throne of judgment in heaven, and he will bring everything to light, and he will judge those who have destroyed, who have turned their back on him, who have warred against his people, and he will reward those who have been faithful to him. Justice will come to all one day. So what are we to do? Given these three truths, that there will always be people who oppose God's people, but that God is always faithful to his promises, and that one day justice will come to all, what difference does that make? As we go out through these doors today, what difference should this make to us? Well, we should bear in mind the words of Jesus Christ, which were read to us earlier in Luke's Gospel, that we are to take up the cross and to follow Jesus Christ. Whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. You're to weigh up, you're to count the cost, Jesus says, of being a disciple of his. Because it's not easy, because you will always have enemies, you've got to weigh up the cost. You're going to say to yourself, is it worth it? Is it worth possibly having to forsake father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters? Is it worth having to give up my own dreams, my own ambitions, possibly my own life? Is it worth it? And some will say, it's not worth it. The cost is too great. And others will say, even my own life, it's worth it. Where does the difference lie? Well, I think the difference must lie in where your hope lies. Do you live for today? If you live for today, for today's pleasures, for today's joys, for the fulfillment of your desires today, you're going to say, it's not worth it. Because being a Christian, being a disciple of Jesus Christ, means carrying a cross. It means denying myself. It means putting my life at Jesus' command, not at my own command. It means doing what Jesus wants me to do, living my life the way that Jesus wants me to live it, so that I will bring glory and honour to him rather than to myself. Now, I'm simply not prepared to do that, some will say. That's too big a price. I want to enjoy my life. I want to have a good time. I want to get out of this world what I can get out of it. And maybe, possibly, later on, then I'll give some more thought to this idea of following Jesus. So what about those who do follow Jesus then? What about those who think about all the pleasures that they could have in this life, all the riches they could hoard to themselves if they lived simply for themselves, rather than thinking about what would please God and what would further his kingdom in this world? What do they see that makes it worth it to give up everything for Jesus? Well, they see beyond this life, you see. And they look towards that day when justice will come to all. And they look at the promises of God. And they see in God's promises something that's desirable. And they see a contrasting destiny for those who are followers of Jesus Christ and those who are not. And they see that this life is just for a moment. It passes away. Generation passes generation and soon is forgotten. Who remembers their great-great-grandparents? Do you know anything about them? Most of us don't. They're gone. They're dead, buried, forgotten. So what did their lives amount to? Not a great deal in most cases. They've passed on. And the same will happen to us. And the person who weighs things up and counts the cost and says, I'm going to follow Jesus, sees that this life is so fleeting. It's over in a moment. And there lies beyond the grave eternity. Forever. Never ending, never coming to a conclusion. And they say, what do I want then? What am I prepared to put up with for a short time in order to ensure the best for eternity? And when they count the cost, they see that by following Jesus Christ, there is a promise of peace. There's a promise of no more pain or suffering or anguish. There's the promise of no longer living in a world that is so marred by sin that every day we're confronted by its pain and sorrow. To live in a world that where everything is truly beautiful and perfect. And we long for that. And we choose that at the expense of pleasure in this life. Because the alternative is not to continue to experience pain as we do now, but it to be a constant factor for eternity. Not to experience a world that, yes, is marred by sin, is spoiled, in many cases is ugly, but bearable. Not something like that, but a world that is so ugly that it defies description. A world where there is no restraint on man's sin, where God is absent in all his restraining power, and man does whatever he wants and brings all the vileness of his impurity to its fullest manifestation. It's something that we cannot fully grasp. The Bible speaks of it as being a place burning with fire and brimstone. It speaks of it as a place where the worm devours, but we continue to live on. It describes it as a place of intense, unquenchable thirst, of utter misery. And people are willing to risk that for a moment's pleasure today. It's hard to believe that more people choose that way than choose the alternative. Why? Why is that? Well, it must be because they don't believe in God, or they don't believe that God is truly just and holy, that justice will catch up with them. But they don't want to obey God. There were people in Esther's day who would not obey the king and went to war a second day against the Jews and lost their lives for it. And there are people today who will not believe the word of God. And they'll risk eternity in hell to have a day's pleasure here on earth. Are you willing to risk all for an eternity like that? Count up the cost. Take up the cross and follow Christ. Esther did it in her way, going in before the king, not knowing whether that scepter would be raised to her. Mordecai did it by not bowing down to Haman. The Jews did it on the 13th day of Adar when they took up their defences against their enemies. And we must do it every day of our lives. But what will you do?